everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, what defines a conspiracy and the popular media and government backlash against those who promote alternative interpretations to historical events? My panel today will begin with Dr. Peter Dale Scott. He is a former professor of English at the University of California, Berkeley, where he was also the co-founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program. He's a recognized poet, a former Canadian diplomat, and a scholar, and the author on the domestic and international political issues involving taxation, war and conflict, the drug trade, the politics of oil, and the assassination of JFK. His theory of deep politics, a term Peter coined, was descriptive as a more realistic way of objectively looking at evidence that would otherwise be characterized as conspiratorial, at least in the mainstream media. He is the author of The Road to 9/11, published in 2007, and more recently has published two volumes in a new series, The War Conspiracy, JFK, 9/11, and the Deep Politics of War, and American War Machine, Deep Politics, the CIA Global Drug Connection, and The Road to Afghanistan. He is also one of the witnesses to appear at the international hearings on 9/11 in Toronto. His website is peterdalescott.net. He will be followed by Professor James Tracy. Professor Tracy is an associate professor in the Department of Communications at Florida Atlantic University, where he specializes in the media history and analysis, the politics of communication, and the sociology behind commercial and alternative news media in communicating current events. He received significant notoriety for his criticism of the news coverage of the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. He holds a doctorate in mass communications from the University of Iowa, and is closely affiliated with Project Censored and is a regular contributor to Global Research as well as other alternative news outlets and academic journals, and he has also written chapters and books. And his blog is memoryholeblog.com. Our final panelist today will be Chris Milligan from Waterville, Oregon. Chris is a publisher, a writer, and musician. He is the founder and chief editor of the Trine Day Books, a publishing house founded to serve as a vehicle to get suppressed publications and controversial authors to the market and reach a wider audience. He publishes well-researched and insightful investigations and analysis on alternative interpretations to historical events that might otherwise be called conspiracy theories. Many of his authors have appeared on this program over the years. In the past, Chris collaborated with investigative reporter Daniel Hopsicker on his book, Barry and the Boys, The CIA, the Mob, and America's Secret History. He is also the author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. Chris's father was employed in secret operations with the OSS in the Pacific, primarily in the Philippines, and later served as the branch chief head of the CIA's East Asian office, before leaving the agency in 1959. It was through Chris's association with his father that an interest in covert operations sparked him early and led him to the creation of his publishing company. The website is trinedaway.net. Nice to have you all with us today. We're going to do this in depth. If any of you have appeared on this program in the past, then you know it is more like a classroom on the air. You've been invited because of your deep sense of scholarship and commitment to seeking the truth, and you're all independent thinkers. The problem is that we live in a society that more often than not will not even entertain the legitimacy of anyone's arguments that is challenging the official positions. As long as you're coming at a topic with a perspective that complements those in power, you are welcomed in. The moment you challenge those in power, you're excluded, ridiculed, mocked, and attacked. Unfortunately, even on Pacifica and other stations, mention the word conspiracy and you're considered no different than a loon. In fact, the hostility has become so rampant that people are now making personal attacks against anyone who does anything that is considered conspiracy, even though these are very popular programs with the majority of the listeners. But it's not the listeners who are voicing their opinion. It is those in power. Go to 60 Minutes. Go to many of the other media. You're allowed, certainly, to present ideas. I've had my own investigation on 60 Minutes, on Lawrence Burton, on 2020, on Dr. Brzezinski, etc. And you'll have some people open the door. More often than not, the moment you mention JFK, RFK, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, 9/11, the door immediately closes. So we're going to start with you, Peter Dale Scott. First, welcome to the program.
Well, glad to be with you, Gary.
We don't have the best connection. Are you on Skype?
Can you hear?
No, we have a very muffled. I'd rather speak with you on a land-based line.
Talk about conspiracy theories. This happens to me over and over when I get on a Skype broadcast in this area. It's not the first time by any means.
Okay. Well, if we have no other way of reaching you, then we'll go continue.
No, I have a landline, 848-6812. Sorry, 510-848-6812.
All right. If my engineer wrote that down, please call him back on his hard line so we'll have a clear connection. And let's also, so engineer, please disconnect him off Skype and we'll reconnect him. And for this conversation, so people who may not have heard us before, it's not a chit-chat show, it's not a back and forth. Instead, I'll give them a larger issue to get into, and then it's up for them to take it in, really lay out in a larger context with details and explanations and examples exactly what it is that they are involved in. I like to, when I'm on an interview, I like to talk about the topic and get to what is relevant. And we certainly give our guests time to do that. Following this broadcast, I'll be doing an in-depth report on Pacifica and WBAI specifically, its future, or likely future. And this is based upon a comprehensive investigation that I did. It took a long time, speaking with hundreds and hundreds of people involved in Pacifica's history and its day-to-day operations, its management, executive directors and program directors, station managers, board members at all levels. And then I look for the documentation that would substantiate the truth of the matter. Okay. Do we have Professor James Tracy on the line?
Yes. Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's take a look in depth about the people who ridicule conspiracies. The people who only have a very limited interpretation of historical events, contrary to what the evidence might show, and how, by controlling so much of the media, they're able to maintain their power over our perception of a given event. Could you take us through some of the events that you have investigated with your sense of scholarship and your emphasis? I've read many of your articles, your emphasis upon detail, and how they compare to the official version.
Well, the probably two seminal events that we have to look at over the past 50 years are 9/11 and the JFK assassination. We know a great deal about both of these events. And let's take the JFK assassination, for example, which, of course, Peter Dale Scott has written on at length. There is still, as we saw with the 50th anniversary last year, November of 2013, we saw that the corporate media, the mainstream media, still seek to have a stranglehold on the information that they're willing to present to the public as legitimate. They still defer to the Warren Commission's explanation of there being a lone assassin, of there being a lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, even though we know through copious documentation that has been released since the 1992 Act that allowed for, following Oliver Stone's film, that provided for much, much more information to be divulged. In addition to the congressional investigations of the late 1970s, we know that the conspiracy took place. It's not a matter of Lee Harvey Oswald being a part of this or whether or not he acted alone, that's not so much the point as is what Jim Garrison, for example, concluded back in the late 1960s, as, for example, what Mark Lane concluded around that time, in that the John Kennedy was assassinated by the military intelligence industrial complex. That is intertwined with the mass media in our country. We know this, in fact, is the case since the late 1940s with the establishment of the Office for Strategic Services and its developments as the CIA, creation of Operation Mockingbird, and the infiltration of the media by the intelligence apparatus by the early to mid-1950s. So the fact that we now have, you know, as was the case with November of 2013, or as was the case in the wake of 9/11, we have these very deep events, these very complex events, whereby the government asserts an official conspiracy theory that the public is asked to ascribe to. And all of a great deal of the other evidence that calls into question that official conspiracy theory is scuttled to the sidelines, and we're asked to ignore that or dismiss that. So that would be, I guess, my long response to your question.
Let's take some specific examples. Go through it as if you were teaching a class and you're using an example of how the official story, as reported by the mainstream media and the so-called experts, got it wrong, completely wrong. And then show us the real story so that we can get the inside look at what happened to create the wrong story.
Well, we might take a look at the 70 hours of coverage following the JFK assassination and how, in many respects, Lee Harvey Oswald was constructed as the principal culprit in that crime. Now, if we are to look at that and even the findings of the Warren Commission vis-a-vis subsequently released government documents, and one could look at much of the evidence and the materials unearthed by the Garrison investigation, we will be able to see the contradictions in the news coverage and how, again, Oswald was largely created as this sole operative, as this sole agent in the act, when it was more complex, again, much more complex than that. Now, that is not to say that all of those involved in the media are directly involved in this particular event, say, for example, in the assassination of JFK. This was something that was presented in a particular way to thereafter be represented by the major media to the broader U.S. public.
All right. For example, when I interviewed Mr. Garrison at length on several times, all told for 22 hours, what he was really frustrated by was the fact that he found out that there were FBI agents and CIA agents both planted in his office, and that virtually everything they were doing, looking at Clay Shaw or any of the other characters involved, over 35 different characters, including those associated with the mob, all the information was always immediately given back to the authorities. Now, why would the government need to have their agents in his office? What were they afraid of? If it was a legitimate investigation by a U.S. attorney or a district attorney, they should have just allowed that attorney to bring whatever evidence they had to trial, and it would have either been right or wrong. The person would have been found guilty or not, as happens every day in courts around the United States. But this was a rare exception. You never hear of the CIA and the FBI intentionally infiltrating an office with his own agents and taking documents, recording all conversations, following all the people that worked in the office, and then every time that Garrison went to bring new charges or add on to the existing ones, he was always thwarted. Your thoughts, please.
Well, yes, and there were, in fact, specific journalists that were also involved as federal informants, including Hugh Ainsworth, who was working for Time Life and Newsweek, in addition to Jim Phelan, who worked for the Saturday Evening Post and was a freelance investigative journalist. They were also involved in terms of infiltrating the Garrison investigation. But overall, Garrison was really onto something, and this was something that the federal government feared. And, you know, in fact, the Clay Shaw defense, Clay Shaw's principal attorney, Ed Wegman, went to the federal government just 2 days after Shaw was arrested by Garrison's office, the district attorney's office, on May 1st of 1967, in an attempt to contact the Attorney General, Ramsey Clark, in addition to J. Edgar Hoover. And it appears that he was able to make contact, and to make a long story short, there were a number of favors that were done by the federal government. And, of course, you know, part of this involved, you know, they were already infiltrating Garrison's office and the like, but part of the quid pro quo between Ed Wegman's legal team for Shaw and was to uphold the Warren Commission report, the Warren Commission findings on the Kennedy assassination, hook, line, and sinker, no questions asked. And, of course, they did that. There's also evidence that indicates that Wegman made overtures to the CIA director, Richard Helms, at the time, in addition to Alan Dulles.
Yes. Keep going.
And there are so it's evident that that Shaw, and there's, in addition to this, there's a memo that more recently came to my attention by Peter Janney, or is it Peter Janney's? I'm thinking of Peter Janney's father. Bit Janney, of course, wrote Mother's Martha Mary's Mosaic. But Peter Janney's father, who was a CIA officer, convened a meeting in September of 1967 in order to determine what the agency was going to do in the event that Garrison would get an indictment, would rather have a conviction of Shaw. This is something that they were anticipating. This is something they were planning on, and the implications were very severe because Shaw, of course, had ties to the agency.
So what did they plan to do if Shaw was found guilty?
Well, this memo was it suggested that there was a committee that was convened in the event that there was a conviction of Shaw. But, of course, this was in September of 1967, and the trial was successfully delayed until early 1969. So there was more than ample time to throw a number of wrenches in to Jim Garrison's investigation in the year and 15 months, or excuse me, year and 4 or 5 months up until the trial of Shaw.
Here's the point that I do not feel has ever been made, and that is that looking back now, there's been dozens of books written about this by scholars in the field. Their research, their scholarship is unparalleled, and yet the major media that supported the official position in the Warren Commission and the experts talking about the Warren Commission have yet to apologize for not taking Shaw seriously. They mocked him, they ridiculed him, they didn't give him any credit at all. And yet,
you mean Garrison?
Garrison, I mean, and
right.
And yet later, the least that Garrison would have expected and hoped for is that he would be exonerated, that all that effort that he went through was correct. And history shows he was correct. There was a massive conspiracy to destroy Garrison's reputation. Why hasn't the media ever come back and said, let's take a look at one of those conspiracy theories that was right? And history now shows it was right. And then let's go from there to the Gulf and Tonkin resolution. How many times have we heard the people on the right and even some of their apologists on the left say that the Vietnam War was necessary, it was instigated by them and not us, and now we have all the information, including Robert McNamara's confessions, that it was not a war that we should have fought, shouldn't have been in, and it was a neocon war. It wasn't just for 10 years or something, or 14 for others, but it was almost 20 years because we've been supporting the French in Indonesia in that war, and we gave them billions of dollars, about $3 billion total, plus intelligence information, plus special training. And when the war should have been over, and they actually sought, the Ho Chi Minh sought a meeting with Western leaders to see about framing a Vietnamese constitution similar to our own, they rejected it. Wouldn't help him. The American public doesn't know this, that we didn't have to have the Vietnam War at all. They were wrong about the dominoes. They were wrong about North Vietnam boats trying to hit the Maddox. And they were wrong about everything. Everything was a lie. So why haven't we held those responsible for that lie accountable?
Well, that's a very big question. But concerning Garrison specifically, it is true that those in power, those that are in public office, that our representatives, what have you, have not come out and exonerated Garrison. But I think at least in some respects, Garrison has been exonerated in the court of public opinion to a large degree as a result of Oliver Stone's film, JFK, of course, which was largely about Garrison. And if public opinion polls are any indication, they suggest that 60 to 65%, some polls suggest more, of the U.S. public are aware that there was a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. And I'm not sure about the remaining 30% or so, but really a majority of the American public, I think, are at least partially aware of Garrison's service in this regard, even though much of it came after he was capable of appreciating it.
Hold your thoughts there for a moment, James Tracy. We're going to come back to you. We now have reconnected with Professor Peter Dale Scott. Thanks for being back on here. Hopefully we'll have a good connection.
Yes, if I can certainly hear you well. I'm sorry I can't see you.
Oh, no, good. We hear you fine now. Please take us through all the ridicule about conspiracy theories and alternative interpretations of historical events contrary to the official report in mainstream media. We missed the main issue about where conspiracies arise from, particularly government conspiracies such as 9/11. And what we were just discussing, the JFK assassination, which brings up your investigations and your writings about deep state.
Right.
So you've taken a look at deep state. You've taken a look at continuity of government. You've taken a look at the people that we are not very familiar with, maybe not at all, who have all along had a plan and are simply waiting for opportunity to implement it so they can have absolute full control over our resources, over governance. And the average person would think, that's crazy. That's conspiracy talk. But based upon the actual research, it's not conspiracy talk. So please take us through, maybe as an example, a continuance of government or the continuity of government. And
continuity of government, COG. I think that is a key. In response to what you just said, you know, I cannot totally identify the motivation for what's going on. But the recurringly we are scammed I think, is the case. And all this talk about conspiracy theories is, I think, primarily to shoot down speculation about some key ones, the Kennedy assassination, 9/11. That's not the total list, but those two are at the very core of it. And a good deal of what is wrong in the country now is as a result of what I call those two deep events. What is a deep event? It's an event that happens, and almost from the beginning, we're going to get false stories about it. We're going to get a cover-up. In both these cases, we got a quite lengthy commission investigation, and then they produced a report where you could see things were wrong with it. So when you get these Kastenstein type of people who say there are people who believe in conspiracy theories, some of us believe in conspiracy theories because official reports lie about what actually happened. So that's anthrax, for example. In my book, American War Machine, I said we had a false flag attack on this country. Remember, the anthrax was delivered, first of all, to journalists, and this is all back in 2001, right after 9/11. And then it was sent to two Democratic senators who were voicing objection to passing the Patriot Act. And it was made to look very crudely as if they were coming from Al-Qaeda terrorists. But in fact, the anthrax came from U.S. military weapons research at labs, and that's a certainty now. The FBI investigation was called Amerithrax, which was a way of underlining that it was American. And it was a conspiracy because the letters that came out were mailed from a different address, but at the same time as the anthrax being mailed out. So there's a conspiracy theory that is pretty well certain, and yet it's never talked about in the press because it's embarrassing, very embarrassing, not just to the government weapons labs, but to the whole justification for why we went to war in Iraq, because it was blamed on Iraq initially.
Take us back to the group of people, including Oliver North and Dick Cheney and others, the neocons, who firmly believed that with a national emergency, they could take control. And yet the public was kept out of the loop on this because we've seen evidence of detention camps. We've seen evidence, but we're told this evidence proves nothing. And yet when we ask, what are you doing with all these detention camps in Halliburton's building? Who's supposed to go there? Illegal immigrants? Dissenting people? Who? You never get a straight answer.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because Oliver North is part of this COG planning, continuity of government planning, that in a sense it goes right back to the early 50s, but it took an entirely different turn under Reagan in 1981-82. Reagan, by executive order, created a very secret committee, and it was not just people in government, it was people in government and out of government, and two of the people who've been on it from 1982 right up to the election of George W. Bush in 2000 were Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. And they spent essentially 20 years planning for things like the three big categories are warrantless surveillance, the sort of stuff that Edward Snowden has finally revealed in a big way, warrantless detention. The two go together. If you're planning to round up, in the Oliver North era, it was officially planning to round up as many as 400,000 people. Well, obviously, you have to know who you're going to round up, so you can't have warrantless detention without also having warrantless surveillance. And then the third one, which we have, and most people don't seem to be very aware of it, is the militarization of Homeland Security, so that we now have an army command, NORTHCOM, which is in charge of events in North America the way that SOUTHCOM is in charge of events in South America and CENTCOM in Central Asia and so on. that is something which neocons wanted desperately for a long time, but was politically very sensitive because it reminded people of what happened back after the Civil War, and there were actual acts of Congress passed, the Posse Comitatus Act, to make sure that we would never have a permanent army occupation of this country. But there is now a permanent brigade waiting to deal with civil disturbances if they should break out. So and they're very much in on the surveillance and on people like me. We used to be watched by the FBI, and now we're being watched also by NSA and by private intelligence corporations. I have a whole chapter about this in my book, The American War Machine. And the Army, too. They're all making sure that things don't get out of line here in America. I think the real feeling is they believe that they lost Vietnam because they lost public opinion in this country. They don't want that ever to happen again. And they're prepared to do what it takes, including, I don't want to say shredding the Constitution, but certainly very severely impairing the effects of the Constitution.
Could you go back to the beginning of how they created it, what they did to implement it, and how certain is the idea that when they choose the time and the place or the circumstance or the special event, even a false flag, then they could take virtually every dissident, every activist in the United States, and disappear them.
Yeah, that's not what I'm really frightened about. I think on paper they could do that, and some people have been quoting from the executive orders and so on, which are pretty sweeping. I think that they hope to detain as few people as possible. But I think they definitely do want to project the idea that it's a waste of time to protest. Because however powerful the people in the streets are, the war machine is more powerful still. And this is a problem for American democracy now, because, frankly, I don't expect Congress to fix this problem. Technically, let me say something a bit about that. 3 days after 9/11, President Bush proclaimed an emergency, a national emergency, and we have been living in that state of emergency ever since. Now, there's an act of Congress that was one of the Watergate reforms passed back in, I think, 1978, was we have a National Emergencies Act, and Congress is required, if there's an emergency declared, it is required within 6 months to review it, either affirm it or terminate it, and it's a good deal more than 6 months since 2001, but Congress has never done that. Even some of us appealed to Congress to do that. They've never done it. The president renews it every year, and then when Bush was succeeded by Obama, we appealed to Obama, all right, don't ever renew this again. But Obama is doing exactly the same thing. Every year in September, he renews the emergency for another year. And all kinds of things are happening because of that emergency. Some of them have been converted into statute. Some of them are still out there without any statutory thing. Some of them very definitely seem to be at odds with the Constitution, such as the... Well, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but many lawyers have gone on and on about this. So it's a serious situation. I don't want to say it's a desperate situation. Obviously, there are other countries where it's difficult to protest and you're likely to be surveilled. And I certainly wouldn't do in Russia or in China what I feel quite comfortable doing here, because this is still, I say, essentially a free society. But it's a free society. It's also trying to maintain an imperial apparatus in the rest of the world. And the requirements for doing that in the rest of the world creates a huge hidden bureaucracy that is very much at odds with the kind of open institutions which the Constitution established for running this country. And that's the basic tension, I think.
When you look around at the world we live in today, could you highlight some of the concerns that the media is not covering honestly or at all, and that that only the alternative media dares take on.
Well, the one that leaps to my mind there is the Ukraine, because, you know, the media covers some issues better than others, and I would have to say they have not, the American media have not covered Ukraine well at all. And, you know, I once worked for Senator Kerry indirectly back in the days of the Contras. I was feeding stuff to his subcommittee on Contras and drugs, and I met him, and I thought he was a hope for America. But recently, the things he said are about, well, for example, when Crimea voted to join Russia, and the Russians accepted this, they are essentially a Russian. It's only since 1954 that they were separated from Russia, rather artificially. And then Kerry said, we don't do that sort of thing in the 20th century. We don't just take over and go into another country. This is like only 10 years, 11 years since the United States went to Iraq without any justification whatsoever. So the media are supporting him in that. So I advise anyone listening to this show, if you have a computer, read what the London Guardian is saying about the Ukraine. Read what any London paper is saying, or any European source of information that you can read in English. It's a very different picture from what we're getting in the American media, and it's I think just shameful that the American media can behave this way when they're quite capable of reporting objectively on other matters.
But they did the same thing with Libya.
Yes, they certainly did, and they were about to do the same thing with Syria, and that was a very alarming situation which was defused. And it was defused largely by an initiative taken by Russia. And that was a very hopeful moment, because Syria is a major problem that can only be resolved by international agreement among the great powers. You have to involve America, Russia, Europe. You have to involve Iran. You probably should involve China, because these are local problems that could very easily become a source of we could see World War III in Syria out of Ukraine. We could have seen it out of Syria, and then we had we had what looked like a hopeful negotiation between America and Russia, and they defused the Syrian thing. There are some people who suspect that things got heated up in Ukraine as a way of blocking that kind of understanding between Putin and Obama, because Obama's not been a leader in this. Kerry has been a leader, but it's people underneath him, Victoria Nuland in particular. Her husband, Robert Kagan, is part of that neocon team that were responsible for Iraq, and I would say for 9/11, frankly. I mean, I don't mean that they bombed the buildings. I mean that they created this state of mind where, well, I'll leave 9/11 out of it, but they were certainly responsible for Iraq. And Iraq was a disaster. No one can say that was in America's interest. No one can say that. Bob Parry has a very good article right now that you cannot claim that what's happening in the Ukraine now is in America's interest. And things have been done by Americans which are demonstrably not in our interest. It's the Germans who say that maybe 400 people from Blackwater or a Blackwater subsidiary are now in the Ukraine helping to aggravate the tensions in the eastern part of the country. That's not in America's interest. And it's not in Obama's interest, because it's threatening to give him problems he can't deal with, and it is threatening to break down the understanding he had with Putin that was beginning to solve some problems. So it's a tense area, and the media, I don't want to condemn them outright, because they do some things well, and if the tide starts flowing in the right direction on a higher level, then the media will jump in and help tidy things up, too. I think they're much better on Syria now than they were before. I think that even there's been some admission that the gas that was blamed, the gas attacks that were initially blamed on Assad, and which American scientists said, no, they weren't Assad, you are getting a more open reporting now on the fact that the rebels are also using gas. We need to have something beyond the mainstream media, and of course the internet is all we have, but it should be used because it's helpful.
My final question for you on this issue is, do you believe that there has been substantial infiltration of provocateurs into the left in order to keep the people fighting one another and always arguing and always in conflict, so they don't unite on issues?
Gary, I've had a half a century to think about that, and I would only question the word substantial. Yes, I think they do infiltrate people. I believe I've dealt personally with people who were visibly, this was back in the, actually it was to do with South Africa when we were trying to get the University of California to divest its investments in companies that were in South Africa. This eventually happened and the whole state of California did. And they now say, I think it was Mandela who said that California was a significant factor in the liberation of South Africa. So I'm very pleased about those things happened. But we had a nonviolent demonstration when the regents were meeting to vote on this matter, and I was a monitor at that meeting. And we had someone who said, this isn't working, we got to get guns, we got to do it with guns, it's the only way to do it. And you knew he was a fake because that's all he could say. He had been told to say that, and he kept saying it over and over and over as if he wasn't a human being. And so we, as monitors, we surrounded him and treated him the way a white blood corpuscle would treat a microbe, and we just moved him off to the side of the meeting and let him go on fulminating. Finally, he just went away. So that there are penetrations is certain. Whether they're substantial, I don't know. The problem is that people like us who doubt the official versions of things, a lot of us start doubting each other, and I've watched a lot of it happen in a way that is lamentable, but I think cannot be blamed on provocateurs. Sometimes it's just the way we are ourselves, I'm afraid.
One little follow-up, because you opened a door here of interest to me. What role, if any, do you believe that the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, or the Soros Foundation, or other philanthropic groups give money to individuals or groups or fronts in order to have some control over the politics of going forward with that individual or group?
You mean here domestically as opposed to abroad?
Yes. Yeah, here domestically.
I'll give a general answer. I have a book coming out, The American Deep State, in November, and I talk in that book how the Ford Foundation has worked with the CIA from the beginning and in a big way from when Alan Dulles became director in 1953, that they... there are many operations which the CIA is involved in, but they don't have enough budget to cover, and then budget comes from... Initially, it came from the Marshall Plan. That there was a sector of the Marshall Plan budget which was for covert operations. And then many people from the, ECA, Europe Economic Cooperation Administration, that administered the Marshall Plan, they went into the CIA, into the Ford Foundation. And the Ford Foundation started doing the same thing. It started backing up CIA operations with funds. This was mostly foreign, a lot of it in Africa, a lot of it in Indonesia. One of my specialties was the overthrow of Sukarno in 1965 and the massacre of 1 million people that ensued. And the Ford Foundation played really a very significant role in that, and I have to say with some embarrassment, my own university, the University of California, was a bit involved too. I've written about this in my long poem, Coming to Jakarta. But whether they, I wouldn't expect them to do anything. You know, they're intellectuals in their way over there. They fund programs that have some kind of superficial justification to them, like giving money to poets in Iran or something like that. And it may serve a hidden purpose, but it doesn't look bad. I can't think they ever had a program to infiltrate people into an anti-war movement. That would look bad on the surface. So my guess would be, no, not directly, not the Ford Foundation. There are plenty of places. I think, frankly, the FBI and the CIA have enough money, because that's not a very expensive thing to do. And I think they certainly during the Vietnam War, we now know the CIA had Operation Chaos. They were infiltrating the anti-war movement big time, and it was illegal. The CIA, by its charter, is not supposed to do that. They did it. And then it was exposed, and I think they said they wouldn't do it again. I don't know what's happening now, but I wouldn't expect that to be Ford Foundation, no.
Okay. I thank you very much for sharing your insights with us. And that's Professor Peter Dale Scott. Now let's go over for our final panelists and say hello to Chris Milligan, publisher of some of the most important, well-researched books on conspiracies. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me, sir, on such an august panel. I'm a bit of a rabble-rouser.
Good. That's why you're here. Chris, tell us about some of the work that you've published that has given you a lot of blowback, where people have attacked you, your publication, your authors, and even if they're not able to deconstruct the arguments your authors have made, because I know that you don't allow any book out unless it's fully vetted for accuracy. Tell us about, take two or three of the most important topics.
Well, it's suppressed. It's suppressed topics. I mean, it really, I found it quite amazing once I decided to publish Anthony Sutton's book, publish another one, and then all of a sudden people just started throwing books at me because of the suppression. And so I'm dealing with a lot of books that had agents. They'd been around New York for many years, and finally the author gave up, and then maybe they heard about me. Well, let's take one book called A Terrible Mistake by Hank Albarelli. It's the story of Frank Olson, the CIA gentleman who we were told jumped out of a hotel after taking some LSD. Well, actually, he was thrown out of the hotel window, and in this book, which this story has been part of the national news cycle several times, we tell in the book who actually threw him out of the window and why, and it was completely stopped by the American media. I mean, I had calls from CBS, from 60 Minutes. They wanted to put an embargo on that story. Don't tell anybody else about it. We're going to do something about it. Of course, they never did. I had Nat Hentoff. Okay, I consider him a dean of American journalism. Wanted to write a story about it. He was not allowed. Okay. We do not have a free press. I mean, the first book that I helped do was Daniel Hopsicker's Barry and the Boys. And, again, it was with, it had been with an agent in New York, and he was on my email list, CIA Drugs, and he was decrying, says, nobody's going to publish my book. I finally says, well, Daniel, I've got a computer on my desk. They tell me we can make a book. Okay, so we made a book. And it was quite an interesting experience. First off, they didn't, you know, powers that be didn't think we'd be able to do it. Finally, and so they didn't really react until we finally got the book off the presses. And then there was a little note that went out through the AP wire that said, oh, by the way, President Bush, the governor of Texas, his most favorite plane that he flies happens to be, used to be owned by Barry Seal. And because then they were trying to put out that if anybody talks, there's no new news in there. It's all old news, and it has just been an amazing experience with several books like Dr. Mary's Monkey, Me and Lee, the suppression that is brought to bear on these stories is just immense, and.
That was based on Lee Harvey Oswald's mistress, and who was doing original research in genetic engineering and cancer-causing viruses. And it was because of the research on the viruses that they were going to kill her, which many believe that that's why she was killed, not her association with Go ahead.
And her story was vetted by the people at 60 Minutes, okay? We have Don Hewitt on videotape telling about how he tried to break that story. He thought it was one of the most important stories of his career. He got her in makeup, in chair, in front of the cameras, and he got the call from upstairs that said, "You can't tell that story." Okay, so, I mean, what is it, what is going on here, okay? It's called psychological warfare, okay? And our media is not part of our media. I mean, it is not the Jeffersonian model, okay? It is the propaganda model, okay? And the media is owned by the people that have captured the deep state, and, you know, it's about control. It's about control of our future. And it's criminal. It is criminal what these people are doing. And it is, Professor Scott talked about, you know, empire and our imperial entanglements. And, you know, there was a big discussion in the end of the late 1800s about whether America was going to be an empire or not. And America did become an empire, but you see, they haven't told the people really yet. We still go out there and do this charade, play this game of, you know, putting our hand across and pledging our allegiance to our republic. Well, we don't have a republic anymore. Okay? And, you know, and you guys earlier were talking about the Vietnam War, and, you know, how I got radicalized was through my father, just by him telling me some things I didn't understand, because my father got involved with the deep state in 1943 when he was in OSS and was sent to spy on MacArthur and Willoughby, and then he did something he wasn't supposed to do. He put some of MacArthur's friends in jail, and they ended up getting rid of him and had to get a gentleman by the name of Lansdale. And Lansdale is very part and parcel of this psychological warfare that has been perpetrated against us people. And it is about taking our country away from us, making us think that, you know, we're the greatest country in the world and blah, 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 all the while we are just being used as a cat's paw to get the world in shape for these forces out of the shadow. I call it the secret societal system. I mean, my father, the first thing he told me in 1969, he quit the agency in 59, and he said he started talking to me because he signed had only been 10 years. And he said, the Vietnam War is about drugs. There's these secret societies behind it. I mean, he told me in 1969 they were playing out a loose scenario. Okay. Why do you do that? Another thing he told me, he says, they're out to opiate your whole boomer generation. Okay, what was going on? And again, there's a reason why they burn books. Okay, some of the first books that we came out were from Peter Lavinda, called Sinister Forces. And one thing they show in there is they show that the people involved with psychological warfare are also involved with the occult, and because they are playing these amazing psychological warfare games against us to control us, and conspiracy theory, quote unquote, is part and parcel of that. There's a great book out now called Conspiracy Theory in America by a professor from the University of Florida, came out from the University of Texas, and he shows how the meme conspiracy theory was basically put into our lexicon by the CIA after the Kennedy assassination to denigrate people, and then it's been used to just dismiss all of the corruption that these elites are doing. I mean, and not just, you know, political corruption, but huge economic and social corruption. And, you know, it's, like I say, I'm kind of a rabble-rouser. Excuse me for getting emotional.
Chris, we're running up the end against this program. Good for you for being the rabble-rouser, because you've published some of the most important books for investigative journalists out there. You collaborated with investigative reporter Daniel Hopsicker on his book, Barry and the Boys, The CIA, the Mob, and America's Secret History, one of the best on the topic, and also the author of the Fleshing Out the Skull and Bones. That was an interesting insight. And so had your father not been the branch chief head of the CIA's East Asian office, you would have known that the war in Vietnam was really about drugs. But that's true in all these wars. Go down and look at the Nicaraguan War. Look at the power regime change. There's always drugs, money, or some natural resource that we're interested in, some corporation or corporations are interested in, and using our Defense Department, State Department, CIA to make sure that they have the opportunity to get it. So thank you very much for all that work you're doing, Chris.
Well, Chris, God bless you and God bless America. Thank you.
Okay, Chris Milligan. Final word from Professor James Tracy, down in Boca Raton, Florida. Final thoughts on the idea that what defines a conspiracy in the popular media and government backlash against those who promote alternative interpretations to historical events?
Well, again, thank you for having me. And I think that one thing that we really haven't had a chance, I haven't had a chance to talk about conspiracy theory perhaps as much as I thought we might, but this has nevertheless been a great conversation. The CIA was extremely instrumental in putting this this very term into our lexicon, as the previous guest points to. Conspiracy theory, it stems from the document 1035-960. That's something that's presented and I think argued quite well by Lance DeHaven Smith in his latest book, Conspiracy Theory in America. And I think that is really one of the few scholarly treatments of this topic that has come out that has been honest and forthright and really kind of taken the bull by the horns in addressing this phenomenon that really does stifle discourse on controversial subject matter.
I appreciate your input. Professor James Tracy, also Professor Peter Dale Scott, and Chris Milligan. Thank you all for joining us on the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Nall.